This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Mackenzie Schirilla is sitting in an Ohio reformatory right now for women. She's 21. She, if you are just catching up on the chaos of this case, convicted of killing two people, her boyfriend Dominic Russo and their friend Davion Flanagan, after she drove a Toyota Camry into a brick wall at roughly 100 miles an hour in Strongsville, Ohio. A judge found it deliberate, premeditated. She's serving 15 years to life, and on a recorded phone call from prison, her biggest concern is getting her iPad. You can hear the call. It was obtained by reporters and published. Mackenzie is talking to her mother, Natalie. And she's asking her to call the facility to push for the iPad. Can you call and ask? Please, please, please. Her mother tells her she can't. The last time she called about something, the prison staff told her it would be considered special treatment. And Mackenzie's response on a recorded line in a state correctional facility where she's serving time for two murders is, "What the F, man?" Not grief, not reflection, not even basic awareness that she's being recorded. Just irritation that the world isn't delivering what she wants on her schedule. In that moment, that tiny, petty, completely unself-aware moment is the whole story of how Mackenzie Schirilla got here. Not the crash, not the 100 miles an hour. The fact that nobody in her entire life at any point ever let her feel the consequence she couldn't complain her way out of. That's what this episode is about. Not whether she did it. A court answered that. This is about the 17 years before the crash that built the person capable of it. And the two people who were supposed to be the guardrails. As we go through this, your thoughts in that comment section there on Substack and YouTube. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching us. July 31st of 2022, Strongsville, Ohio. 5:30 in the morning, Mackenzie, 17 at the time, is driving home from a friend's house with Dominic, 20, and Davion, who's 19. The car, a 2018 Toyota Camry, makes a controlled turn into Elmita Drive, then accelerates nearly half a mile at close to 100 miles an hour. No braking. The car slams into a brick wall of a commercial building. Dominic and Davion are pronounced dead at the scene. Mackenzie is extracted from the wreckage and airlifted to a hospital. Black box data showed the accelerator was pressed to full capacity for an extended period. Forensic examination found no mechanical failure. Brakes, steering, tires, all functioning. The judge who heard the case called her hell on wheels and found that she'd crashed the car intentionally. In August of 23, she was convicted of 12 felony counts, including four counts of murder. She was sentenced to two concurrent terms at 15 years to life. That's the case, okay? We're not going to relitigate the case here. It's established. It's been upheld on appeal. The Ohio Supreme Court declined to even hear it. What hasn't been established, what nobody really has sat with, is the question underneath. How does a 17-year-old get to the point where this is even in the range of possible decisions? And the answer is not just she's a monster. You know, I get it. But monsters don't build themselves. After the Netflix documentary The Crash put this case back in the national spotlight, a series of prison phone calls between Mackenzie and her parents were obtained by multiple outlets. And if you want to understand how Mackenzie Schirilla was built, those calls are the blueprint. In one call, Mackenzie and her mother are discussing prison life, the programs available, the educational opportunities, the mental health resources. Mackenzie says she appreciates that they try to make it somewhat manageable in there. And then Natalie mentions that prison is supposed to be rehabilitative. And Mackenzie says on a recorded line, "But I don't need to be rehabilitated. Like, I don't need that." Set that down for a second. A woman convicted of two murders, a conviction upheld, saying she doesn't need rehabilitation. That's not really defiance. That's not bravado. That's a person who genuinely does not believe the thing that happened is the thing that happened. And here's the part that matters. Her mother does not push back. Nellie doesn't say, you know, Kenzie, you were convicted. We have to deal with this reality. No. Why would she do that? Why would she try to hold her daughter accountable now that she's finally locked in a cage? Because the world has held her accountable because they failed her so badly. She tells her daughter rehabilitation is for actual criminals. Not you, she says. People who have been convicted of actual crimes. Their daughter was convicted of actual murder by an actual judge on actual evidence. And on an actual recorded prison phone call, Natalie Shirilla is telling her that doesn't count. In another call, Natalie refers to the family of Dominic Russo, the young man her daughter was convicted of killing, as evil people. Not because they did something evil, because they're grieving. Because they blame Mackenzie. And in Natalie's framework, blaming Mackenzie for the thing Mackenzie was convicted of doing is an unforgivable act and makes you evil. And then there's Steve. Steve Mackenzie. Dad. Pothead extraordinaire. And look, I'm not dissing it. I'm a user myself. But why that was even brought up into the documentary as some sort of a selling point for your behavior or the choices that you're making or allowing your daughter to make, or like, it truly reeks. Reeks of very low-level problem-solving skills, critical thinking, parenting skills. Steve, you really probably shouldn't be a dad, in my opinion. But you are. And you have been, and you did what you did, and you raised a daughter this way. I don't think you've done anything necessarily. Well, you actually probably have done some criminal things by allowing your daughter to do what she's done. But I don't know. Maybe I'm. That would be for a court to decide. Allowing your daughter access to those. I don't know what the laws are there. I'm assuming there might be some possible repercussions for being the cool dad and being down with her getting all doped up and whatever else was going on that you knew about and didn't intervene on as a responsible parent. There might be some laws broken there. Could be. I don't know. Not an attorney. I'm just saying might be. Nothing that I think like you need to go away for or anything needs to be litigated, but I'm just saying. Steve. You may be the cool dad, but where'd that get you? Your daughter's life is destroyed, and you're still being cool on Netflix. He's an art and digital media teacher, or was, at a Catholic school in Cleveland until they said, we're not going to renew your contract. And he said, I wasn't going to come back anyhow. I know you are, but what am I? Steve appeared in the Netflix documentary and said on camera that he had no problem with Mackenzie using marijuana. His words, I don't have a problem with her smoking dope. If you're going to take a drug, that's the one I believe you should take. It's better than alcohol. It's better than all the other crap. Not for a developing brain. Really, none of it's good for a developing brain at all. But I'm glad you're cool with it. I'm glad your run-on rant there really was more about justifying your own poor decision-making in your series of short self-confirmary sentences. I'm glad you've calmed that anxiety down within yourself and you've told yourself enough times that you were just doing the right thing, that you're good with it. How'd that work out for you and your daughter? He said it on a Netflix documentary about his daughter's murder conviction. In his capacity as a teacher at a Catholic school. And when the school placed him on administrative leave and ultimately did not renew his contract, Steve's response wasn't reflection. It wasn't, maybe I shouldn't have said that on camera. Maybe that was, it was that the school and the diocese showed their true colors. Yeah, in a remarkable moment of common sense and accountability for the people of which they employ, the fucking Catholic Church, the Catholic school, the diocese, made a competent decision. That in itself is to be applauded and a rare thing in the world. I mean, for a group that's great at covering things up, wow. Steve talking about dope was a bridge too far. Like, I agree. But at the same point, it's like, where is your bar over there, Catholic diocese, of like what's acceptable and what's not? The attention gets too strong, then we got to cut. But if nobody's really looking very closely, then everything is going to be okay. We'll just move this little pastor or this priest from here to this church, to that church, and never tell anyone about his love of children. What is the bar? He talks about dope on camera. He's gone. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe you're fixing up things over there. I can have the two feelings at the same time, hypocrisy and justification. They both land in the same arena with me because we look at things honestly here. When Mackenzie faces consequences, the problem is the people who impose them. When Natalie faces the reality of what her daughter did, the problem is the family that's grieving. When Steve faces professional consequences for his own words, the problem is the institution that employed him. It's the same operating system running on three different machines, really, and it's been running on Mackenzie's her entire life. It's the preloaded software, if you will. And here's where this stops being just a Mackenzie Shirilla story and starts being a story about every parent who's listening that recognizes something. Because I think that's really the crux of this story. And why so many people have been watching The Crash on Netflix and identifying with it and feeling something visceral, and why we've been talking about this 1 hour and 30 minute documentary so damn much. It's because every person in this audience knows a version of this kid. And probably these parents. Not a killer. That's the extreme. But the kid whose parents always had an explanation. The kid who never heard no and had it stick. The kid who got pulled out of every uncomfortable situation before the discomfort could teach them anything. Every teacher knows this kid. Every coach, every employer who's ever hired a 22-year-old who couldn't handle being told their work needed revision. Now layer social media on top of it, a generation. This is not every young person, so don't hear it that way. I'm young and I'm great. Consider yourself lucky. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about people like this, and you know exactly who I'm talking about. So don't make this about you and start pointing the finger. Yes, that's right. Point the finger. Accountability. Shame. Other people need to start feeling it. Why are we in a situation in a world where there's so many Mackenzie Shirillas out there? Because we stopped doing that. Because we stopped holding people accountable and letting them feel their shame and sit in their shame and learn from their shame. Shame's not there just to make you feel shitty. It's there so you learn and not repeat the same maddening poor choices over and over again. But somehow we've hit it into our heads with a sledgehammer. That shame is bad and must be avoided at all costs. Shame is part of life. Shame is part of our spectrum of feelings. And you don't know the opposite until you feel the real thing. You can't feel the true highs of good choices, of good decision-making, the satisfaction that comes along with that if you don't ever feel the opposite of it. Everything is just neutral if there's no up and down. There are so many people living in this lane, a generation, like I said, and this is not every young person, but a significant number of young people building entire identities online with zero life to back any of it up, curated images, performative confidence, a personal mythology constructed from filters and captions and follower counts and no mechanism anywhere in the system to say, that's not real. You haven't earned that yet. You don't know what you're even talking about. The emperor has no clothes, except the emperor is 17 and has 3,000 followers and thinks the followers are the clothes. Young people have always been like this to some degree. I have, you have, we all have been young. Young and dumb. Every generation thinks it invented wisdom at 19. That's not new. What's new is parents who agree with them. What's new is an architecture that lets the mythology go unchallenged indefinitely. And what's new is that when reality finally shows up, and it always does, there's an entire support system built not to help the kid process it, but to help the kid avoid it. And if you want proof that the persona survives even a complete collision with reality, look no further than Mackenzie Shirilla in prison. A fellow inmate who served alongside her described Mackenzie as someone who showed no remorse and compared her to a character, or the character, Regina George from Mean Girls. Daily makeup, social posturing. Treating a state correctional facility like a high school cafeteria with a longer dress code. The curated identity running on autopilot in a place where it means absolutely nothing. That's not a hardened criminal learning the ropes. That's a kid who was never stress tested against anything real, dropped into the most real environment there is, and still performing the same character. The numbers back it up. Since entering the Ohio Reformatory for Women, Mackenzie has accumulated 36 conduct violations. She was found guilty in 32 of them. 7 counts of being out of place, 6 contraband filings, 4 direct order refusals, unauthorized medication, belonging to another inmate, altered prison-issued clothing, refusal to carry out a work assignment, visitation violations. And when her mother asks if she could get a job mopping or sweeping to pass the time, Mackenzie says they won't let people with her charges get jobs. Then admit she hasn't actually asked anyone about it. This isn't someone struggling to adapt to consequences for the first time and finding it hard. This is someone who has never adapted to consequences and sees no reason to start. The prison is just the latest environment that's supposed to bend around her. And when it doesn't, when it refuses to deliver her iPad or let her skip work details or give her special treatment, she calls her mother and complains that she's bored. She doesn't eat the prison food. She wants to know why the day is going so slowly. She has one book and she's not planning to read the same book over and over again. She's 3 years into a life sentence for killing 2 people and her emotional register is indistinguishable from a teenager whose flight got delayed. But she doesn't build herself. And this is where it gets uncomfortable for anyone listening who's a parent. Go back to Steve. He went on a national documentary defending his convicted daughter and casually endorsing her drug use on camera. He lost his teaching position at a Catholic school for it. And instead of recognizing that maybe going on Netflix and saying you're fine with your teenager's drug use while your daughter sits in prison for killing 2 people was a miscalculation. His takeaway was that the school betrayed him. His focus, in his own words, is the injustice my daughter has been put through. His only focus. Let's go back to Natalie. She's on the recorded prison line, and her daughter, convicted by a judge, sentenced to life, upheld on appeal, tells her She doesn't need rehab. And Natalie says, that's right. Rehabilitation is for real criminals, not you. That's not support. That's construction. That's the mother actively building the walls of an alternative reality her daughter lives in. Brick by brick, on a recorded line while her daughter sits in prison for driving through an actual brick wall at 100 miles an hour. The Shirillas didn't just fail to prepare their daughter for reality. They constructed an alternative one and moved the whole family into it. And they're still doing it. Steve blames the school. Natalie blames the Russo family. Mackenzie blames boredom. Nobody in this family at any point in this entire process has said the words, this happened and it was wrong and we have to face it. That's the machine. That's the factory. And it's not unique to the Shirillas. Christine Russo, Dominic's sister, said it in an interview. They created a monster. They're the monsters themselves. That's earned rage from a woman who lost her brother. And she's not wrong about the result. But Steve and Natalie probably don't look like monsters to themselves. They look like loyal parents. They look like the only people who didn't abandon their daughter when the whole world turned on her. And that framing, that specific, common, terrifyingly recognizable framing, is what sits at the center of every one of these stories. They confuse protecting their daughter with protecting her from reality. And those are two completely different things. Protecting your kid means teaching them that actions have consequences, that the world doesn't recognize itself around their feelings, that being uncomfortable is not the same as being attacked. Protecting your kid from reality means intercepting every consequence, rewriting every failure, and making sure they never have to sit with the weight of what they've done. One of those builds a person who can survive contact with the world. The other builds a person who drives 100 miles an hour into a wall and then asks for her iPad. Mackenzie Shirilla isn't bored in prison because she's a different species. She's not collecting conduct violation because she's uniquely broken. She's bored, and she's defiant, and she's performing a character nobody's watching because nobody, not her parents, not her social circle, not any structure in her life, ever let her be uncomfortable long enough to learn that discomfort is information, that discomfort is where you figure out who you actually are instead of who you've been performing. She had 17 years to learn that, 17 years of chances for someone to say, no, Mackenzie, that's not how this works. You don't get to skip the part where things are hard. And nobody said it. Or they did. And if they did, Steve and Natalie made sure it didn't stick. The distance between I'm supporting my child and I'm building a person who can't survive contact with reality is shorter than any parent wants to admit. And Mackenzie Shirilla is sitting in the Ohio Reformatory for Women, complaining about her one book and her missing iPad and the slowness of a Tuesday afternoon is what looks like when you get to the end of that distance and discover there's a wall. She still says she doesn't need to be rehabilitated. And the two people who could have told her otherwise are still agreeing with her. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in. We'll continue the conversation right there. Links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to us. Apple Podcasts, take us with you wherever you go. YouTube, Spotify, whatever it is, hit subscribe. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's go to another case that has been huge this week. Mackenzie Shirilla never talked to police. She never testified. The case that put her away for two murders was built on evidence, surveillance footage, the car's own data recorder, a digital trail of threats, and what investigators pieced together after the crash. The question that runs underneath all of this is, how do you prove a murder when the weapon is a car and the defendant never says a word about wanting to kill her boyfriend or her friend? Joining us to discuss, Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI Special Agent, host of Break the Case, available wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Let's start here. Mackenzie never talked to police, never testified. The whole case was circumstantial. How do you prove someone intended to kill when they never say a single word about what actually happened? Obviously, it worked. The judge said, yeah, we knew what your intent was. But was that the right outcome? We've talked to everybody this week about this now. Jen, I'm curious to get your reaction. It's your turn to take the bat from Deacon and take a swing at Mackenzie Shirilla exactly how you would like.
All right, the pinata is yours.
When you're talking about cases, when you go in as a case agent, you should never think, oh, I'm going to rely on getting a confession or rely on what they're going to say. The way to go into a case is saying, listen, I need to look at all of this evidence objectively, see what is out there, and piece together a case to your puzzle that doesn't involve a confession. Because then if you get everything put together, that's when you go and talk to the person. That's when you have everything on the board that you can hopefully convince them it's in their best interest to talk to you about what happened. In this case, she was smart, never said anything. But come on, this evidence is overwhelming. Her digital trail is obnoxious. They have the car. She's done.
I like that digital trail is obnoxious. And so the debate all week, Jen, and so this is what we'd love to you to weigh in on. So here's the debate. There is no debate that she was the result, her actions resulted in the death of two people. That's irrefutable. Irrefutable. That's the word I was looking for. Thanks, Tony. So irrefutable that's what her actions caused. What we keep going back and forth on all week is, what was her intent? Because, again, we keep going to that intent thing. The judge says her intent was to kill her friends. Again, kind of paraphrasing there. And some of us are saying, well, that doesn't quite fit the data sets that we're getting on this, because we don't see her being suicidal. We don't see her intentionally wanting to murder someone, although because she's a stupid narcissist and she's using the vehicle as a fear lever of manipulation, like she's already done before, that her intent was to manipulate people into compliance and they happen to die, including almost herself. And so I guess that's what we're kind of looking at, is where do you line it on that from what you're seeing from your experience? Do you think the intent was to murder, or is the intent to use fear and they died because of her stupidity?
I think the intent was to murder. I agree with this judge on this. Look at what we have before us. Two dead people.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. That's where I lie on it. You don't race a car at humans and not think they're going to die unless you just literally don't understand the outcomes of something like that.
And that's where I think it lands.
Yeah, and that's where we're going back and forth. Yeah,
did she understand? Just like some idiot that doesn't understand the power of a weapon, of a gun, if you will. You know. Obviously, there are certain things you do and don't do with a weapon, loaded or not. You take it seriously. There's idiots out there who don't understand that wave them around, that do stupid shit. And then sometimes, oh, surprise, that's a loaded weapon, and you thought it wasn't, and it fires and it shoots somebody. Now, because they were stupid and waving it around doesn't mean that they intended to murder somebody, but the result of their stupidity and their actions and their narcissism and all of that resulted in this. Is this similar to that? How is this different than that, I guess? In your opinion, from the evidence, what stands out to you, Jen, that makes you say, just like the judge did, that this is beyond just recklessness or stupidity? What's landed with you?
I think what's landed with me is the obvious nature of she would understand what a car would do. We're not talking about a three-year-old in, you know, looking up and you know, not understanding the breadth of force of a vehicle. So I just do not buy anyone who murders people with a car saying, oh, geez, I had no idea that could do that.
That do you think
plan as being logical?
Do you think she went into it with the intent of killing herself? Or do you think the narcissism, the ego didn't even consider that, hey, you might die as well?
You know, I think when people do these types of crimes, that they are more focused on the intent to kill than they are what could happen to them in these particular cases. And in this case, that's how I see it. I see that her decision did not keep into account what could happen to her, the extent of what could happen to her.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it was then, and I can see that if she's so blinded by rage and so blinded in the moment, and that's why I guess where my question is going, do you think this was then premeditated, that she had an intent beforehand to kill them, or was she caught up in the moment?
I think that she premeditated. In other words, I think that this is something she probably thought about way before this, maybe not in this particular way, but I think the rage and the hate that somebody experiences, it goes in and out. They keep thinking about it, and then an opportunity presents.
And what do you think then about the reactions that, again, the only data we really have is how Netflix edited it. So we're kind of limited in that cut that we had. So we had two things that stood out to me, which were data points when assessing this as well, was how the parents shared her reaction when finding about Dom being murdered, killed, as well as the his friend and her friends in the back seat. And it seemed to be... it was an interesting reaction. And then you also then had her with the bracelets on that they wanted to remove from her when she went to jail. Do you think that was because she was making a show? Was it because she had empathy about it? I mean, how do you think her reactions when finding out basically about the, them being dead? Were they genuine, insincere, cinematic in any way?
Well, definitely cinematic. But having said that, there are some people that actually... once they everything happens, the gravity of the situation, they actually do have some regret. And I think that this could be a combination of possibly some regret, but mostly a show.
The parents have been making headlines all week. I know you've seen it. I've seen it. We've all seen it. We've all been subject to the parents of Mackenzie Shirilla's verbal diarrhea on the internet over the last couple of weeks here. Do the parents, I mean, it's a very broad question. I don't really know the mechanism to which it would be handled, but do the parents bear responsibility in any way, shape, or form for what their daughter's actions were?
I don't think so in this case.
No.
Nope. I can't see it. I can't see the connect.
Just
no crumblies there, right?
I mean, because that's the interesting thing. I don't see the connect other than just really irresponsible parenting. I mean, is this just simply a look into a world of, well, here's how the sausage is made. When you make it that way, when you follow this recipe, this is what you get. Surprise, surprise. What's your reaction to so many folks when they see Mackenzie's reaction from prison? They look at it as, oh, she's dismissive or she's not taking this seriously. We've heard some of the phone calls between her and her mother. What's been your reaction to the communications between the parents and Mackenzie from behind bars that we've been privy to?
You know, I really believe that people like Mackenzie, she had in her mind what is going to happen once I'm behind bars. In other words, this isn't just like you're thrown into something and you have to react. This is something she had imagined in her mind. What was she going to act like? What was the relationship going to be like with the parents, these conversations and everything? So I guess, I don't know, to sum it up, she was ready for it and we're seeing Mackenzie. I don't think there's anything further beyond that.
That's really interesting. So I hadn't considered that aspect of it. So do you believe it was premeditated so much from her standpoint that actually she was actually thinking about what life in prison would be like, because you think she was playing that tape forward enough that she was anticipating it?
I do. I really do. I think that is what makes sense to me in terms of a lot of these people. They know that when they're up for these kinds of criminal charges, they've thought about it over and over and over again. Just think, with anything in our lives, something that is huge, whatever that might be, that could be our future, how you think about it, even like a move, right? Okay, whatever. And I think that was played out for her.
So in order to do that, so she has the cognizant ability to kind of play that tape forward to plan what life in prison is going to be like from your perspective after the actions of this take place. What do you think is hindering her from being able to plan forward to her parole hearing, where she has got 36 violations against her, 32 are found? In other words, for as much planning as she seems to have done, she's really sucking at it right now if she ever wants to get out.
Well, I don't think she cares. I mean, she didn't care whether she killed two people. Why does she care about these violations? In other words, I don't think that's in her recipe. I think she's the type of person that does everything for the moment, does things the way she wants, and then the repercussions she'll have to face. But I think it's more important to her that she live and does the things she wants to do. I mean, how many times have we come across these personalities?
Yeah.
Well, yesterday we were calling her Corey Richens, the training bra, is what Mark Fry, I think, online said yesterday. She looks just like her. I mean, she's going to do this at some point, right?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt like at some point, no matter what was going to happen here in the, when you look at the trajectory of Mackenzie Schirilla, if this wasn't what landed her in prison, something else would. It was a matter of who and what were going to be her victims as the human tornado that she is. Fascinating to get your insight on it. I've been watching your tweets about it this week, so I'm glad we got a chance to discuss. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Another case that's still getting a lot of comments here. And since we're doing Q&A this morning, drop them. The crash, Mackenzie Schirilla, two boys are dead. Dominic Russo was 20, Davion Flanagan, 19. Mackenzie Schirilla drove 100 miles an hour into a brick wall, and a judge called her literal hell on wheels. But our audience isn't just asking about Mackenzie anymore. Netflix, of course, put the parents on camera. The prison calls are public. The question that keeps coming back isn't about guilt. It's about who spent 17 years building the person who got behind that wheel. And a lot of your questions are focused on the parents. We've talked about the parents in depth, but we'll do another round of it right here. Feel free to drop them into the comment section wherever you're watching us on the live right now, or if you're watching the replay, go ahead and drop them. This conversation is far from over. Robin Drake, of course, with us, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's go with this one. Steve Schirilla went on Netflix and said he didn't have a problem with his daughter smoking weed. He said, if you're going to smoke a drug, that's the one you should take. He was teaching at a Catholic elementary school. And I think the thing that everyone goes to, how do you say that on camera and not see what happens next? Dawn on YouTube had that one. Because I don't think he makes good decisions. And that's the answer. Robin?
It just says it all right there. I mean, his lack of understanding of cause and effect in any aspect of life, it's just such a supreme arrogance to think that you're smarter and better than absolutely everyone around you, the people that employ you, the police, the public, you name it. You know, that is a person living in a huge self-centered, self-righteous methodology. And so what do our kids learn? Our kids learn from our behaviors how to interact with the world around us.
And if your daughter thinks you're a successful person because X, Y, and Z, they're going to do exactly the same behaviors that you do because they think it's a successful path in life. And it's that's why the adage, apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So that was just, again, emotional intelligence. Part of emotional intelligence is understanding our impact on others and how that affects them. And this person is completely oblivious to what cultural and societal and norms at the place that employs you expect you to do.
Another thing with that, I want to add in where he talked in the doc about when she was being abhorrent to the school staff, saying horrible things to her teachers, being extremely disrespectful. I mean, just you can't do that in school. And the school, they call her out. She's at the principal's office. He shows up and he says basically, and I looked at her and asked her, did you do it? And she said, no. And I said, come on, let's go. And I picked her up and we got out of there because I know she didn't lie. Despite the school staff all like, this is the shit your daughter just pulled. He's not holding her accountable in any way, shape or form, going, I believe you, and going with it. I mean, what is that? Is that narcissism? Because narcissists so often see their children as extensions of themselves, not as their own individual people. And if this is how, if he sees himself as kind of being, I can break the rules and kind of do what I want to do, he's going to view her the same sort of way as the extension of himself and not accepting the consequences to any sort of actions. I'm wondering if that says more about him, not wanting to accept reality, accept consequences that come along with having a daughter that's out of control, because that would mean his parenting is out of control. And that's rather than deal with it, it's just, nope, not true, walk away.
That's just an ego out of control. That is a massively inflated self sense of self, which again, sense of self, understanding of self, that is emotional intelligence. He is bottoming out on EQ. He's got zero because think about it. There's five elements that make up someone's emotional intelligence: our knowledge of self, our knowledge of others, our impact on others, problem solving capabilities, and how we handle stress and decision making. Think about all those five factors. Where's he at on all of them? Zero. but that's that huge self-centered ego. That was made by someone as well. His arc in his life would be really interesting to look at. And here's where it becomes a massive problem. His loving critic, his wife, feeds it.
Yeah. You know, they all feed it. It's like it's a toxic swamp.
It is.
Shit.
And that's why when you hear and listen to all the prison calls, it's a family maelstrom of self-centered chaos. Because they keep feeding each other. There's no loving critic that says, hey, maybe you should take a breath. Maybe go out and walk and touch some grass because you all are so full of shit that you're believing it. And they all have fallen in love with their own voice. They all think everyone else in the world is out to get them. They're total 100% victim mentality because in their own world, there is no other victim but them. That's why they're incapable of showing any sort of remorse except just words. No emotion, again, that incongruence between words, actions, and deeds that gives you that creepy something's off feeling is because they don't feel what they're saying when they even say anything regarding the victims' families and the loss of life that their daughter caused. She's the victim. They're coming after her. They're coming after us. Shame on them. We can now be life coaches because we understand how life works. What the fucking hell? You are, yeah, these are, you know. My sidebar, and if anyone's ever wondering if we're living in some sort of simulation, this is proof we might be, because this can't be real. These people are a program. How can this human being even exist in this world? They're such nutters.
I 1000% agree. What is your take on this, Robin, like from a behavioral standpoint? And I'm curious, have you seen this, you know, in your professional work? The family developed their own secret language to communicate. I remember the first time I heard the prison calls between mom and Mackenzie. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? I thought like the audio was off. I thought I was having a stroke for a second. I'm like, what are they saying? I can't understand a word that's being said. And it's like, oh, they're speaking in like pig Latin or something. But it's like their own little, you know, Cyrillic language that they came up with to get around monitoring. Well, prosecutors figured it out because, surprise, surprise, the fake language that Mackenzie Cyrillic and mom figure out is not that hard to decode. Turns out it doesn't need like a Nazi box to get through. What do you make of that? The fact that they made up a fake language to try and get around monitoring on a recorded line.
So, sorry.
That's weird.
Well, you just got, so here's how my brain works on these things. Well, that's not the first time they did that. So
yeah.
What caused them to do this many years ago?
Yeah, good question.
They have been talking shit around other people their entire lives. As a matter of fact, they probably got caught at one point talking their shit about people and they got called out on it. So what did they do? They came up with a way to talk shit around people and no one understood what the hell they're saying. So they could keep talking shit. That's exactly what that is. And when you combine that with some, you know, because you hear twins sometimes when twins develop their own language because they're so closely bonded, you know, so people want to feel special. They want to feel closer. We're going to have our own special language. And our own special language is for what? It's not for love. It's so we can talk shit about you right in front of your face and you have no idea what we're saying. I mean, it's, again, fall in love. They fell so in love with their own voice. They made up their own voice.
That's true. God, it's just, yeah, welcome to the simulation.
It didn't just happen. Things like that just don't happen. It happens on an arc. No one says, all right, I'm going to prison. Oh, shit, we got to quickly develop our own language so we can talk behind people's back on an open line. No, it's been done for years. I really wonder the first time they came up with this idea. You know, this mouthy little group that thinks they're better than everyone else was talking shit all the time, because it's what everyone at school said what a bully she is. Everyone at school says how mouthy she is. Where do you think that came from? It just didn't pop out of her mouth one day. Her mother and her have been talking shit about everyone their entire lives, and they had to come up with their own language because they couldn't control themselves in public spaces. That's why they did it.
God.
And they're still doing it because prison's a public space and they're still doing it. They're incapable.
And I guess it's so fascinating because it's about as stupid as going at 100 miles an hour into a brick wall. Doing this on a recorded line, the fact like there's no thought of consequence. There's like no equation that someone is going to look at this and go, what the F was that? Like, and then figure it out. It's almost as if I'm going to do this and no one is going to be the wiser, no matter what. Yet everyone keeps being the wiser. I'd love to know more of the history of this family and their social interactions with society, because I can only imagine the horror stories and the tornado of life that all three of these people have been to anyone unfortunate enough to have crossed their paths.
Well, you know what they are, because the dad said it right on camera. You know, he can say whatever he wants because I'm smarter than everyone else. And she's doing exactly the same thing. And so she picked it up from him because he thinks he's smarter than everyone else. You know, regardless of what school rules, school policy or anything else is, I think it's okay for my daughter to smoke pot. And you know what? I don't care if I'm teaching elementary school at your school. I'm smarter than you. You can't fire me. Oh, shit. You fired me? Huh. I'm still smarter than you. Screw you. I mean, see what I mean?
It's so. Yeah. I mean, it really is quite simple at the end of the day.
They're idiots.
This is a case where, it's all it is. It's a family of self-centered narcissists, and this is what you grow. It's a family of weeds.
They grew her.
Yeah.
It's a family of weeds. There you go. I like that.
It is. And it's a family of weeds. It's like you have your garden spots, like, there's flowers growing here. Like, oh, it's a bunch of shitty weeds.
And here's, now going back to the thing that really matters, and that's the victims. You saw, again, we only saw what we saw on the special on Netflix. You saw Dom and his entire family recognizing, get away, get away, get away. I mean, yeah. I've had my own family members, you know, deal with some really crazy people. And you're like, dude, we don't do crazy. You know, that's literally the phrase in our family all the time. We don't do crazy. I don't do crazy people. And crazy is that. When I see a wobble of something deviating from the norm baseline of what you would expect healthy people to do, I mean, Tony, we're friends, you know, Todd, all of us, you know, we just stayed the fuck away from crazy.
Yeah.
And he was trying to, but she had the levers, man. She was using, again, this is how this whole thing happened. She used that lever of fear. She discovered I can scare the shit out of people into doing what I want in that car.
Mm-hmm.
Until she decided to go way too far and kill them all, except for herself.
And unfortunately, the reality is empathetic people are quite often drawn into crazy because
they think they
can
save it.
They're trying to save it. They're trying to help it.
Yep.
I've had my own track record of that.
Yep.
Relationships. And thank God I'm not into that anymore.
I'm allergic to stupid too, okay? Yeah,
but I get it. I mean, I get it. But having, once I got some reps in that, once I had reps in experiencing the crazy, you're like, because I think a lot of empathetic people don't realize the depths as to just how crazy some people can be, unless you're a big fan of true crime or have lived a little bit of life.
Well, and also when you start getting healthier people around you, so the difference in feeling you have, I mean, just look at our friendship, you know, our crew here at Hidden Killers. We are a great, wholesome, empathetic group. And when you have that, now that you have a contrast between what you thought was love, caring compared mm-hmm. to this, you're like, holy shit. There's you can recognize it so far out because it's way out there. You see a wobble way out, 1,000 miles in distance, man. It doesn't even cross your mind anywhere. So far out there. And as people start walking towards it, you can say, hey, no, don't go over there. It's Nutterville mm-hmm. over there. You just grab them. You know, here's our society right here. Don't go near crazy. But you only know it if you have context. Again, everything's a dichotomy. Crazy and nutters and non-crazy. And so you only know it if you experience it.
I agree, because it creates that baseline of what is normal and what is not. Once you start saying it, we're going to do a merch store very soon, by the way. I said, I think I don't do crazy would be a good shirt along with nutterers. You know, maybe like one each side. I don't know. I just thought of that as we were talking.
And don't be an abhorrent, abhorrent conglomeration of DNA goo or whatever it was.
So we'll have to go back and get that made up. I can only imagine the graphic we can make for that.
A bucket of goo is all you are, man. You're just a bucket of abhorrent DNA.
Of rejected. Well,
all because I refuse to call you a human being.
I love
it. Rate. You just don't rate.
All right. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube, wherever you're watching or listening right now. We'd love for you to weigh in and be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you're listening or watching, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever it may be. Hit subscribe so you don't miss anything and take us along with you. Also, Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It is available wherever you get books. Leave a review for this on Amazon or Audible or wherever you're getting it. Very much appreciated.
And thank you for joining me in my camper. I'll be in here all week long. We're visiting my son, and that's why I wore my Bucky's t-shirt. We stopped on the way down. We're down in South Kekalake.
Have you tried any of the food at the Bucky's? Have you gone in and experienced the gourmet delights of the Bucky's?
So yes, my wife is a lover of all things sugar, so we do always have fudge that we pick up from mm-hmm. there. I got a brisket taco that's actually sitting in the fridge because I eat pretty healthy, pretty healthy, and so I'll only have like I'm one of these annoying people. I'll have like a bite or two and I'll put it back in the fridge for a couple days.
in moderation there. They have delicious, the Bucky's nuggets are pretty good.
Yes,
the little like corn puff things.
Yeah. Yes, I do like Bucky's nuggets. Definitely Bucky's nuggets. So here's a sad thing, sad and great thing. So I live in an area, I live in Virginia, mm-hmm. Northern Virginia, and we literally have a brand new Bucky's going in about 10 miles from my house.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
you're lucky. Not a lot of people do.
So I live right in between. We got a new water park that's going in Kalahari just south of us, and we got Bucky's going in just north of us. And so we got a great destination video.
Kalahari is pretty amazing. I know the people who own that started in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Dells.
Yeah.
I did a video years ago on another podcast, another show called The Taste Spot. Went around, did travel and food videos, and did a weekend at Kalahari in the Dells. Amazing place and really nice. I don't know if the family still owns it or if it's expanded out.
Still the family. Actually, I'm friends with the guy who's now the chief of security there. So here's what we got to do. We got to get Crime Con so that we might
someplace fun.
Get Crime Con and go to Kalahari. I might show up now.
Do it at a water park. Yeah, I think that would be a fun place for it. I go if it was at a Kalahari. I would totally do that. All right, there you go. It wasn't an advertisement for Buc-ee's in Kalahari, but in case you're wanting a great vacation,
keeping it real,
you can hit a Buc-ee's and a Kalahari close to Robin now. So
that's right.
There you go. All right, your thoughts, like I said, in the comments. We will talk again soon. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, and myself, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.